Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week, and we're very lucky to have him, is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Let's start with the governor, as we often do. His thing is that he will not ever give up, publicly at least, on the idea that he needs the money from the feds in order for the state to stay solvent. And he's down at least $30 billion in the next 2 years that we know about. Meantime, the state is getting sued for starting to cut back on how much they're giving the schools, but he still continues to say, hey, I need that money and they have to give it to me. The president of the United States, to go on a little bit, says, well, you know, we have to give more money than the Republicans in the Senate want. That was interesting. And that will raise hope with the governor, right, that he's going to get his money for state functions. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think hope is one thing and reality is something entirely different. I think you're right. I mean, look, Governor Cuomo has been saying consistently for months and months and months and months that the feds have to come to the rescue of New York State. And yes, it's a giant hole. I mean, they're talking a $14 billion gap this year. They're talking bigger gaps in out years heading forward. And that is money that simply is not going to, you know, materialize in state coffers, particularly when you're having an economic downturn, you know, caused by coronavirus. Now, keep in mind, the Republican Senate is not necessarily in a mood to kind of bail out New York. Mitch McConnell has made it very clear that he doesn't want to engage in what he calls blue state bailouts. And of course, New York is as blue as they come. And in talking to, you know, sources in Washington, they say that more than likely what would get passed is some sort of skinny bill, and the House doesn't want that, and neither really do Senate Democrats. So there's a little bit of a standoff, a little bit of a stalemate. Now, as you mentioned, President Trump has said this week that he now wants more money, and I don't think there's any coincidence that proclamation comes less than 8 weeks before an election. You know, the polls right now for Donald Trump do not look particularly favorable, although polls are flawed, as we all learned in 2016. And I think that the president is well aware that, you know, solving the coronavirus funding issue could win him some votes in critical states. Now, that being said, I still don't know that the Republican Senate is going to come to the rescue of the nation, let alone of New York specifically, with a big bucket of state and local aid to kind of bail out not only Albany, but also the municipalities around the state, which are really, really suffering already.
Now, Jesse McKinley, that, of course, brings us back to where we started on this, and that's Plan B. Obviously, this governor, he can deny it, but he's got to have a plan B for how he's going to make up for those $30 billion. I mean, you can't run a car on empty. So what's he going to do?
Well, absolutely. You know, you talk to financial people and they say there's only three ways out of a situation like this. You either cut, you either borrow, or you tax. And those three verbs, none of which are particularly appealing. You know, you don't obviously want to borrow money to cover operating expenses. Taxes at a time when the economic, downturn is affecting, you know, a broad swath of New Yorkers is not particularly appealing. And cutting, of course, which has already started at a lot of local levels, it results in reduction of services. You know, if you talk to progressives in Albany, however, the one that seems to appeal to them most is taxing the rich, you know, is that asking the very well-to-do many of whom, coincidentally, have done pretty well during this crisis, you know, because of surges in the stock market and other financial derivative products. They've actually increased their wealth. Progressives in Albany would say, look, the wealthy in the state of New York should pay more, that they should help get the state out of debt. And there are numerous proposals to raise taxes on the ultra wealthy, you know, people earning well more than $1 million, some cases more than $1 billion, in order to kind of fill the hole. Now, Governor Cuomo has been steadfastly resisting this by and large, although there seem to be some cracks in his armor this week, perhaps as he started to realize that maybe the feds aren't coming to the rescue.
Well, you got the two leaders, both Democrats of the various houses, and they are, I think you've been using the word progressives. There are some people who would use a different word, a little less flattering, in terms of saying we should tax the rich, not out of philosophical motivation, perhaps, but more out of convenience. Now, this governor has been getting along with these folks in both houses. Does this threaten a fracture?
I don't know that it is so much a fracture as it may be a hairline fracture. You know, this may not be a break, rather. It may be just a hairline fracture. You know, keep in mind, you know as well as anyone, that the governor holds enormous power in the budget negotiations. You know, he really does hold all the cards. And this year, as coronavirus became, you know, a crisis in New York, the governor passed a budget, basically, and the legislature passed a budget, and the governor signed it, that basically gave him enormous powers to cut services as things progress, to cut funding, basically, to localities as they figured out how bad the financial situation was. And the legislative leaders signed off on that. You know, now as we get further and further away from the terribleness of March and April, there has been some talk that the legislature will try to, you know, use their power to make laws to try to pass some of these things. But as in all things in Albany, they're generally not going to pass something that they know the governor is going to veto or not approve or simply try to water down a negotiation. So, you know, there is some rumbling amongst the legislature that they want to do these sort of tax measures, but, you know, they haven't voted on them yet. We're halfway through September at this point. I haven't heard of any, you know, pressing plans for them to come back this week. But, you know, as the clock ticks, maybe that pressure will increase and that, you know, tension between the state house leaders and the governor will increase as well.
So you're the Albany bureau chief for the New York Times, the greatest newspaper in the world. And really, you have to be very smart to have that job. So I'm going to ask you this question. Of the three choices you gave us, which one do you think is going to end up being the way that the governor saves himself and the state?
Well, talk about buttering my bread. None of the statements you said before were honest, but I'll let those go. You know, of the options that the governor is presented with, as I said, none of them are particularly palatable. You know, I think that of the three, you know, taxing, cutting, and borrowing simply is not going to happen. You know, they can't borrow $60 billion to get the state out of a hole. They already did short-term borrowing just to kind of get over the hump this year when the tax deadline got pushed back. You know, and he argues, Governor Cuomo argues, that there's no way to tax your way out of this, that $60 billion in taxes is not going to materialize, you know. So of the three, you know, cuts are probably the one that will be the most practicable. You know, he has the mechanism already built into the budget to do so, and he's already started to make, you know, minor cuts. But keep in mind, you know, the 20% that he's talking across the board is going to hurt. You know, these are schools you're talking about. These are hospitals you're talking about. This is healthcare you're talking about. So these are not pleasant choices, any of them. And I really do think that he thinks in his heart of hearts that, you know, that the feds will eventually come to their senses and that Chuck Schumer will prevail upon Mitch McConnell to open up the coffers, but I don't see that happening. You know, the other thought process that could be working here in the governor's mansion is that, yes, we have a big election coming up, and that, yes, if the Democrats were to, say, seize power in the White House and seize power in the U.S. Senate, that, of course, that would be a much more friendly environment for a kind of bailout package. That, of course, wouldn't happen until January, but maybe his calculation is, look, if we can just get through the fall, you know, maybe get some of the, you know, some of the economic activity going, get a little bit of the tax money coming back in, we can kind of, you know, nibble around the edges until we get a Democratic Washington in place, and then maybe they'll come to the rescue. I don't know that that's his thinking, but that's a theory that has been floated.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, everybody's going to sue the governor and sue the state. The teachers are going to sue or are suing and saying, hey, you owe us this money. You can't take this money away. And then even more slightly insidious to the political process are the police unions, who are now solidly lining up behind the Republican candidates who would help the Republicans take back the state Senate from the Democrats, which has huge implications when you think about the fact that we're going to be going into a new gerrymander, or whatever you want to call it. And if the Republicans have the Senate, that would be huge. So tell me, Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, do the police unions have enough clout to be able to unelect all those new recently elected, including Long Island state senators?
I think they're certainly going to try. As you mentioned, the police unions came out this week and did say that they were going to try to back Republican candidates, you know, to, as you said, try to win back the state Senate. You know, I think that it is a little bit of a long shot. I think certainly in, you know, more moderate districts on Long Island, they may have a shot, and the Democrats may be playing defense in some of those districts, particularly where, if you remember, well before coronavirus was the hot issue and the terrible issue, there was this little thing called bail reform, which was viewed as, you know, a complete political disaster for the Democrats, and that Republicans were kind of chomping at the bit to use as a political issue in 2020. Now, of course, flash forward to now, and bail reform is well down, I'm sure, the list of voters' concerns on Long Island and elsewhere. But still, you know, those sorts of law and order issues are something that President Trump is making central to his re-election campaign. And I think down ballot Republicans are trying to as well. And it will be interesting to see how much traction that issue gets. You know, with Republicans in New York, it is always difficult because this is a Democratic state. You know, the Democrats outnumber Republicans more than 2-1. And while there are certain sections of the state that have Republican, kind of strongholds, more and more of the state, even in those, you know, you're beginning to see some purple. You know, there's a district in Buffalo where the Democrats feel pretty confident they're going to win a seat in the state Senate where Sean Ryan is running. Who's an assemblyman from that area. They're also bullish about a couple of seats in Rochester that they think they might pick up. So while the Republicans certainly are hopeful that they can use law and order to kind of, pry away independents and kind of more conservative, moderate voters in the middle, at the same time, I think the Democrats say, look, this is going to be a big year of Democratic enthusiasm as Democrats come out to try to get Donald Trump out of the White House. And they're banking on that sort of grassroots kind of excitement to kind of even build on their majority in the state Senate. So, you know, I don't see the Republicans winning back the majority. I think they would do well this year to kind of hold their own.
Let's talk a little bit more about COVID and the colleges and universities. Obviously, this is a terrible disaster area. I'm sure you're keeping up with it. Kids go back to school. There's an outbreak. There's a question as to whether they can continue, whether they can stay open. Some colleges and universities, particularly in the private or independent sector, are in real fiscal danger right now. They're just reeling. So let's talk about higher education for a moment, Jesse McKinley, and see what you can make of it for us.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think what you saw at SUNY Oneonta, where you had, you know, hundreds of cases kind of in the student body, break out, you know, shortly after the term began in the fall, that was a real crisis there, and obviously opened some eyes in other parts of the state. And I think to go beyond the state's borders for a second, you know, the decision by the Big Ten to, you know, resume football, you know, at the end of October is an interesting one, not necessarily because the political pressure that Donald Trump put on those colleges to reopen their football programs, But it shows you the kind of fiscal stress that, as you mentioned, colleges are under. And obviously football brings in a lot of money for those schools in the Big Ten. But it does underscore this idea that colleges everywhere really are kind of facing a serious problem in that they don't have a lot of the income coming in that they're accustomed to, whether through athletic programs or through, you know, dormitory rentals or through food programs or through all of these things that kind of are ancillary income for college campuses. And I'm sure that college towns are suffering as well, you know, as those college students either don't come back or come and stay in their dorm rooms. You know, the kind of economic trickle down here is going to be continue to be felt. And then, of course, from a healthcare perspective, you know, again and again, you're seeing college students come back to campus, congregate in close proximity, either with masks or sometimes, unfortunately, without masks, and you get outbreaks. And, you know, it's something that obviously bedevils public health officials and state officials like Governor Cuomo. And it's you know, a problem that doesn't seem to have an easy solution at this point until there's a vaccine and people can kind of get in close, proximate settings again. And unfortunately, college is a place where people commingle. So, you know, I don't think there's an easy solution at this point. I think the state has said, look, if you have outbreaks of more than 100 people, we're going to force you to go remote. And certainly that seems to be a good precaution. But, you know, in a lot of cases, the outbreaks had already happened. So, you know, I think remote learning will kind of be the rule of thumb for a lot of college students, you know, for the foreseeable.
So, Jesse McKinley, let's talk a little bit about the economics of higher education, if we can. There was that story, I believe it was in your paper, about the NYU professor who said he did a study, and these are the private or independent colleges that are likely to go broke, not to be able to make it. Have you been following that one at all?
I haven't followed that closely, but as an NYU alum, obviously, I'm
me too.
I'm concerned. Yay, there we go. Go Violets. You know, I am certainly concerned about my alma mater losing money. You know, keep in mind, though, too, a lot of those private universities do have endowments, and they, you know, presumably have smart financial people who are trying to keep them afloat. But as I mentioned before, you know, the drawdowns in the number of people on campuses, you know, a lot of people are taking the year off. You know, I know my nephew was planning on going to college this fall and just said no, said I'll take a year. And I'm sure that those sorts of kind of personal decisions, you know, flow upwards and end up in a, you know, financial crisis for private and public colleges. So, as I said, this is going to be an ongoing issue.
Now, while we're on the question of higher education, the governor did something. He named one of his closest aides, Mr. Malatros, as the SUNY chancellor. And people said, ah, that's cronyism. Is it?
Well, you know, I think Jim Malatros has a pretty good reputation in state government. He had been director of state operations prior to becoming chancellor of SUNY Empire State, I believe, and then chancellor of the entire university system. You know, his predecessor in that job was not there for very long. And I think that this is a moment of crisis, as you said, in state and private universities. And I don't think anyone would say that Jim hadn't certainly done a decent job as director of state ops. You know, he had not obviously run a university system the size of the state university system, which is enormous, I think 62 or 63 campuses. So, you know, it's tough to find an equivalent job to say, oh, well, he had done, you know, University of California system, thus he can do University of New York system. So it's somewhat unfair to say, well, he didn't have the qualifications, because there's very few people that do have the qualifications to run a system as massive as New York. And I think he has a pretty good reputation. Now, that being said, of course, he was a very close aide to Governor Cuomo. Cuomo tends to keep a very tight shop. You know, the number of people that he has in his inner circle is pretty small. You know, the joke around the Capitol is that his inner circle is so small it's a dot. And Jim was part of that dot. You know, he was in the inner circle, and then got a very big job at SUNY. So was it a surprise? Perhaps if you're an someone who follows education, it might have been a surprise. If you're someone who follows politics in Albany, it didn't surprise me at all.
Well, just to be clear on this, as a lifelong professor, I think it was a great appointment. I hate to interject that, because if I'm a SUNY professor, I would want somebody in there who has the governor's ear, not somebody who has been spending their entire academic career counting gnats for one thing or another. So there is that. Let's talk a little bit about voting. What's your insight into the way in which voting is being rolled out in New York State for this big election?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question. You know, obviously, the June primary had a lot of issues, particularly in New York City, where results were delayed for weeks and weeks and weeks, and people accustomed to kind of election night had to get used to election month. You know, I think that was a primary, and we are looking at a hard-fought general election in November, which will probably have a factor of 5 or 10 to what they had in the primary. So I think there is concern at every level that absentee balloting will cause problems. You know, obviously the controversy at the post office has raised alarms at a state and federal level. And state officials are kind of scrambling, as are local officials, to kind of get ready for November. You know, the underlying thing here, though, is that much of, you know, the voting system that we are accustomed to in any other cycle, any other pre-pandemic cycle, was geared towards people walking into polling places and, you know, signing the ballot book and then casting your ballot. And a lot of people are not going to do that this year. You know, this is going to be an absentee, probably majority election in a lot of places. And, you know, if what happened during the primary happens during the general, you know, you may not have results until December. And I think that will upset people, particularly when you're talking about, you know, a presidential election where a lot of people are already worried about, you know, election hacking by the Russians or, you know, the Republican leaders, including President Trump, suggesting that the results will be invalid or fake or what have you. You know, that sort of rhetoric doesn't, you know, quell any concerns that election results, which are the cornerstone of democracy, will be respected and upheld. And so there's a lot of nervous nights for election officials at every level. And keep in mind that most elections are run, of course, out of county board of elections. And these people are doing the absolute best they can, and they're trying to staff up. But it's tough to staff up when there's not a lot of money in the bank. So, you know, I think it remains to be seen if this, there will be problems. But I would not anticipate that, you know, it's going to be like any other election year. I don't think you're going to be able to tune into CNN at 10 o'clock on November 3rd and know who won. So,
Jesse McKinley, you wrote a piece about drop boxes. What's a drop box?
Drop box is essentially a spot where you can drop a absentee ballot into, you know, basically just a box, a metal box that sits at your board of election. It's you know, a fairly common practice in heavy vote by mail states. You know, when you talk about vote by mail and you say absentee balloting, and they're fundamentally the same idea, but, you know, with a couple of wrinkles, you know, the vote by mail has been a standard operating procedure in a small cohort of states, you know, in places like Washington, Oregon, for years and years and years. And they have gotten kind of more accustomed to, you know, these sorts of things where you would walk into an election board or a polling place on election day and drop the ballot actually into these boxes rather than having a kind of personal interchange with an election official or a poll volunteer. So these are not radical concepts, but they're new for New York. And, you know, keep in mind, New York for decades was kind of behind the rest of the nation in electoral reforms. You know, even things like early voting, which other states had been doing for years and years and years, New York only really adopted in 2019 when the progressives and kind of liberal wing of the state Senate took charge there. So I think New York's playing catch up on a lot of electoral stuff, and absentee balloting is just one of those.
So, Jesse, Rudy Giuliani's son, Andrew, says he may want to run for mayor of New York City. Is that a possibility? Could he win?
I have not followed his prospective candidacy particularly closely, although obviously the Giuliani name, like, say, the Cuomo name, or like, say, the Clinton name, is a famous political name. in New York State. And, you know, certainly that helps with voter recognition. And the Democrats right now on that side, there's a lot of prospective candidates, and a lot of them seem to be kind of gunning to win over the once again, the kind of left wing of the Democratic Party, which has a lot of energy and a lot of voter enthusiasm right now. So the idea that maybe a Republican could come in there and make a credible argument that he could run the city better than these fractious Democrats on the left, sure, potentially. You know, New York City has had Republican governors, or rather Republican mayors in the past, you know, including Mr. Giuliani and Mike Bloomberg. And I would not be surprised if Republicans think they have a shot with this next year. Now, keep in mind, I think that city has gone through a terrible crisis with Corona. I think Republicans are going to be judged at a state and local and federal level on their response to Corona. And I'm not necessarily sure that's a winning argument for the GOP.
So I see we have almost no more time, but I see de Blasio and his staff are talking about people fleeing, reacting to it, and we have a real crisis in that they are furloughing themselves because the money is so scarce. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, I think that is a measure that may have some marginal financial impact. You know, the governor was asked about this on Wednesday and kind of sloughed it off and didn't suggest that it was going to happen at a state level. But I think even the symbolism of that, the idea of the mayor of New York basically taking a week off to save some money, I think that sends a message that things are pretty serious in New York.
Jesse McKinley, I cannot tell you how proud we are to have you here talking to us and telling us what you know. And if you don't know it, no one does. So thank you so much for being with us. And we look forward to future engagements.
Anytime, Ellen. Thank you.